Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 40 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is War and State Building, Pakistan and Comparative Perspective. Today's guest is T.V. Paul. He is a leading scholar of international security, regional security, and South Asia. Mr. Paul received his undergraduate education from Kerala University, India, and international studies from Jawaharlal Nehru University, New Delhi, and his PhD in political science from UCLA. He is the author or editor of 15 books. His 2009 book, The Traditional of Non-Use of Nuclear Weapons, was selected for the Peace Prize Laureate exhibition honoring President Barack Obama by the Nobel Peace Center, Oslo. He is the founding director of the McGill University Center for International Peace and Security Studies. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Paul.
Thank you very much for having me. Let me thank the Hinckley Institute, to Jane, to Stephen, and Benjamin, who will be speaking after me. This is a great honor. I've never been to a wonderful city, and yesterday I came a little early and walked around the town area and some of the very interesting areas, and I found it a big difference in terms of space and politeness. You know, it's nice to be in a civilized part of the world in many sense. But anyway, I just want to... Because of the time limit, I won't go too much into introductory remarks, but it is great to be at this institution. And Professor Lobel has done enormous work, including some with me. So I'm very honored to be here. And your department has got... I met some graduate students. Many of them sounded like they have very interesting projects. So my problem that I'm trying to address in this particular presentation is coming out of the book that you... notice in the back, is about Pakistan. Why Pakistan is an important country? As you know, it is a pivotal country of South Asia. It is the sixth largest now, something like 185 million people. It could become 300 million by 2050, and the fourth largest country. A peace within Pakistan and between its neighbors in Pakistan, essentially very important for not only for regional security, but for global security. Many works on Pakistan, it's quite a few prominent ones these days, are by journalists or think tank scholars, and they tend to describe what's going on there. Social scientists, unfortunately, have ignored this country, and I think that's where I am coming in. And I don't want to claim I have all the answers for all these complex countries' problems, but I do have an argument that you will hear me in a minute. And I am trying to draw ideas from different social science disciplines, humanities, especially historical sociology, international relations, comparative politics. And so my effort is to bring in that literature, try to explain as much in a readable fashion as possible. I want to make a disclaimer here, which is a very emotional situation. When you talk about Pakistan, the immediate question is, what exactly are you trying to achieve here? I'm not trying to blame Pakistan. I'm not trying to take sides on the India-Pakistan conflict. I am trying to be a social scientist as much as I can and try to understand a puzzle that is of much importance to public policy. And I do have a unique experience. I've been lived in South Asia, traveled to that place for the last 25 years. I've been reading on this and drawing from my IR and comparative politics understanding. My larger context here is the European experience. There is a powerful school of thought in sociology that those of you have done work argues that war and war preparation have been very crucial for the formation of nation states, as well as their strengthening and their cohesiveness over a period of time. Charles Tilly makes the famous statement, "War made the state and state made war." It happened through a multi-stage process: elimination of external rivals, suppression or pacification of internal enemies, extraction of sufficient resources through increasing taxation, strengthening states made social pacts with powerful social groups that conferred them legitimacy. And states accumulated capital that they used later on in their competition with external and internal actors. Now, this doesn't mean all European states became strong as a result of what you call war making. Some really got destroyed, and while others, the war was causing the revolution, and many became rather weak as a result of preparing for war. Some prominent examples of states that disappeared as a result of war making are Byzantium, Burgundy, Austria-Hungary, and the Soviet Union. The last two were great powers. Yet war and war preparation have been very crucial for the strengthening of many European states. Now, scholars have tried to apply this to the developing world, and some of them have applied, especially in Africa and Latin America. And although Tilly himself later on argues that his model doesn't quite fit into the developing world. Despite that, there is a Tillian school, and a lot of them try to apply this to developing countries. Jeffrey Hirst, for instance, argues that African countries did not face what he called the wars of conquest because of their low population and large-scale territorial abandoned vacant land that was available. Therefore, the rulers focused on their capital cities and urban centers, leaving their hinterland underdeveloped. Miguel Centeno argues that the relative weakness of Latin American states ought to be understood from the fact that they are incapable of fighting big interstate wars, and therefore they focused on internal conflicts. Now, I find two problems with this particular set of literature. One is the problem of circularity. It's kind of a methodological problem. And the other is the assumed inevitability of a positive correlation. Circularity means original weakness did not allow these states to wage big wars, which in turn caused them to remain weak. In other words, assumed inevitability also is questionable, because even if you win big wars, you don't necessarily become strong. France was a winner of World War I. Great Britain, World War II. Both declined, or their empires declined, after they won the war. In the post-World War II period, I argue in this book that war-making is a very counterproductive enterprise, unless, of course, the state has other strategies, which I will discuss in a minute. And state-building is no longer purely based on the coercive capacity of the state, but on the integrity power of the state and the ability of the state to invest in its people. The national security states that became strong adopted what you call a trading state or a developmental state approach, and they focused on internal development in addition to, of course, an international trade in addition to, of course, war preparation. Now, this is where Pakistan comes as a great example of, unfortunately, the developmental state approach was not adopted except for a brief period for whatever various reasons one can talk about. But this is my puzzle, why Pakistan did not become strong despite focusing enormous attention on war preparation. Since it became an independent state in 1947, it had been intensely prepared or preparing for war and to some extent fought four wars. Out of that, the first war, 47-48, 65, 1971-1999 Kargil War. And the military ruled over something like half of its existence. The rest are democratic interludes, but I've called them hybrid systems, as the military has still got the veto power on many crucial issue areas. Pakistan has been in competition with its larger neighbor, India, which is where it was created by the partition. And it is something like 1 to 7, 1 to 8 is the ratio difference on many measures of power. But it has been trying to seek a strategic parity with with India, and this has been achieved to some extent through participation in great power alignments, acquisition of weapons, especially nuclear weapons, and of course nowadays participation in with non-state actors to some extent. So what does it say about Pakistan? Before I say some good news, that is the grim statistics, it is unfortunately in the top of various indexes of state weakness. Failed state index is one that Foreign Policy magazine puts out every year. Pakistan unfortunately appears in the top 10 or 12 or whatever. Performance in the areas that is listed there. And obviously the many parts of the country are controlled or affected by the Taliban violence or a particular group violence. It is an epicenter of terrorism and mindless sectarian killing. 2013 alone, you have something like 5,000 security and 40,000 civilians were killed in this process. It stood at 124 among 144 countries in the Global Competitiveness Index. It's one of the least globalized countries in terms of economic dimensions of trade and investment, but it does have 110 nuclear weapons, and it's planning to deploy tactical nuclear weapons. Some silver linings, let us not be all negative about it. It has made some progress in democracy or transition from one democratic government to the other without a military intervening last year's election. And Prime Minister Sharif is trying to encourage peace with India. Military is remaining in the barracks. It is getting positive feedback from European Union for more economic interaction. The dialogue with the United States that includes, for a change, trade. Yet the prognosis is not good. And you know Taliban has stepped up his attacks. And Afghanistan could unravel. That will affect Pakistan in a very negative way. So that's sort of the background here. My problem that I'm interested in understanding the weak state syndrome, why Pakistan did not become a strong state, despite this enormous focus on military preparedness. And secondly, why hasn't its elite changed its strategies when they realized they were not getting the kind of strength that they really deserve? And these two are puzzles, and I have a comparative sort of argument here. I developed two arguments. One is the peculiar geostrategic circumstances, and the other are set of ideas that the Pakistani elite in general hold. And so this is sort of linking in international relations what you call structure and agency, trying to understand the broader parameters and trying to understand the internal dynamics of this particular puzzle. And these are really related to each other. And unfortunately, in Pakistan, think that it's all the fault of the outsiders, especially great powers that got into this kind of crisis or conflicts. But I argue that it's both, it's internal strategies that they adopted to utilize these great power interactions. I don't argue that Pakistan did not face any conflicts. I don't argue that India's policies did not matter. I don't argue that that it is all the fault of everybody else or Kashmir didn't matter. Any of that is not my argument. I am arguing that countries that faced big rivalries and territorial disputes have adopted different strategies if you look at different countries. And this is where the ideas that elite hold matter. So I'm kind of developing an eclectic sort of approach here. I come up with a logic that is prevalent in comparative development. You might have heard about the notion of foreign aid curse, or the other is oil curse, then natural resource curse. These ideas are based on the notion that if a country has too much of one source of revenue, it may not have the energy or interest to do the reforms necessary to become, for instance, a trading state or a powerful economic state. And so I argue there is a literature on geostrategic rents. I argue that rents, if a country gets too much of it, it's not just direct rents it gets, but through other forces, including the international financial institutions. It may be playing the great power game too much, and it may not be doing the reforms internally. So this is why I argue that similar to resource curse or foreign aid curse, a country can be endowed with great power importance in the great power system, and that it could be a valuable country, and the allies would bail it out whenever it is facing a crisis, as it is happening today. Essentially, the IMF and yesterday or 2 days ago, the Saudi Arabia provided an aid. to tide over the current crisis with the foreign exchange. When you get too much of that, there is no great incentive to innovate your economy or do the kind of thing that is needed to become a strong economic power. And two examples I have in the book are Pakistan and Egypt. Now, there are a lot of pathologies involved in this, what you call foreign aid curse, but at the same time here I'm talking broader than foreign aid curse. It is a geostrategic curse, and it actually applies to all these conditions that we discuss in terms of democratic development, authoritarianism, and the development or lack of development of a strong middle class, and the patron-client relationship that comes out of it, and also that productive sectors are never invested in because allies will bail you out. Now, Pakistan's biggest challenge is one of the world's least tax-collecting states, which, by the way, is one of the biggest indicators of the strength of a state. That's also what Tilley and others use to look at the European state's ability to extract resources from internal sources. It also gets quite a bit of foreign remittances that actually increases the problem of lack of need for fundamental reforms. And I have the amount there. Now, one can argue it is not a big amount when you compare it to the Pakistani GDP, but it is a big amount of the total governmental money that is available to the government. And it has been focused very little on trade. And this is where the biggest biggest criticism I have in the book is not on Pakistan's security policies, but it's not focusing on international trade and international other areas that it could have used its alliance relationship with its great power patrons. So it has become a kind of a military ink. There's a famous book by a Pakistani scholar called Aisha Siddiqa, Military Incorporated. Siddiqa argues that military is everywhere in terms of Pakistan's economic activity, and they also get land when they retire from the army. They are given land. It's a bit like a landed aristocracy of the Wilhelmine Germany, of course, a poor country in many sense. And there is little incentive on the landed aristocracy or the military to innovate too much because they have continued benefiting from this system. And so I look at the aid that it gets, etc. But I also go into the ideas that drive the Pakistani elite. That's basically a 500-strong group of people at the top tier. And Benjamin's dad, Steve Coins, I'm relying on his powerful book called The Idea of Pakistan, where he argues that this group is essentially, of course, it changes over time, but it is still the top tier. And they are driven by a number of ideas. And here I apply the notion of ideas not as a constructivist, but as someone just typical international relations scholarship of people like Cohen and Goldstein, etc. The key thing is ideas are often principled or causal roadmaps, and that's where our elite develops strategies. And they put blinders on people, and especially with respect to the number of alternatives they can look into. And I argue that these ideas offer a really powerful understanding of where what the elite thinks of the particular reasons for their situation and the goals they seek and the kind of institutions they create. And they affect over time rigidity in strategies. And until new ideas emerge, and these ideas are questioned often by progressively oriented middle class or elite group, as happened to the Brazilians, the Argentines, the Chileans, or even the Soviet Union under Gorbachev. So, what are the dominant ideas of the Pakistani elite? I argue that it comes out of a Hobbesian worldview. National security state is the primary function of the state. Essentially, it is all that we talk about in extreme realism, self-help system, relative gains matter. National security takes precedence over everything else, that is territorial security. Trade and economic welfare are secondary only to help the national security state. Extreme conflict is the nature of interstate politics, and preservation from predatory adversaries is the primary function of the states. So it is in contrast to what you call the Lockean world or the Kantian world, of course. Those are not very dominant worlds in the entire South Asian region, even for India. Armed forces are a model for Pakistani society, and deep-rooted social reforms are, including land reforms, universal literacy, are too risky. Now I'm quoting Cohen's words. Too risky for a state that was already unstable and pressed from the outside by dangerous enemies. Some of these ideas are drawn from British colonial eras. This is where I think much research is needed, whether South Asian states, including India, have ideas derived from British era. And all the approach toward Afghanistan, the strategic depth and all that, is very much connected to what the British were thinking of Afghanistan as the vassal state, as the buffer state from foreign adversaries. Conflict with India is natural, and to avoid defeat, it has to achieve strategic parity. And this parity is achievable, even though it means enormous effort to attain this parity. And the support of the great powers and the alliance relationships they created and weapon systems, today nuclear weapons, provide that. I offer a different dynamics of the strategic parity argument, which most of the scholars who deal with this region think of it as a military parity. I argue that it has a civilizational root to it. The desire for parity has deep roots in South Asia's history. It can be traced to the demand for a separate Muslim homeland to regain the lost power of the Muslim minority and the conceptual inheritance of the Mughal Empire. Let me just show you the Mughal Empire. You will notice that this empire was actually quite big. The founder of the empire came from Uzbekistan, Babur. And when we talk about regions, actually it doesn't make sense. In today's world, we don't consider some of the parts of Central Asia as part of South Asia, but it was very connected. And during the British period, this is the British India. You notice that the grey or the shaded areas are the British the independent or semi-independent states, 500 plus, and the rest was under direct control of the British. And Britain, once upon a time, had control over Burma and even up to Singapore. So regions change as per the control of the state or who controls the state. So let me sort of argue that from my point of view, the biggest challenge was the 1857 first revolt or first war of independence, the Indians call it, and the British call it a revolt or a mutiny against British rule, against East India Company. And it happened under the leadership of Muslim rulers of northern India. And the British got very angry with them, and they suppressed them. And then they were the elite of India under the Mughal rule, and they were lowered in the social hierarchy and status. So when Muhammad Ali Jinnah was trying to create his independent state, it was not purely for this religious sort of thing. It was also to regain the political power that the Muslims had, or at least from his party's point of view. And that a secular India, as Gandhi and Nehru were all trying to create, would not have given that kind of importance to the religious aspect of or the civilizational aspect. So I argue that it is a competition for status that Pakistan is engaging with India, and vice versa to some extent, although India now moved over to China, it's competing for status with China, which is actually one interesting topic, dynamics which not many people have talked about. And I draw a lot of literature suggesting that many in Pakistan thought this was a successor to the Mughal Empire. That even, but they didn't get everything they asked for. Punjab was not given completely. They thought it was completely going to go. Bengal, same thing. And of course, the biggest of all, Kashmir, which ended up with India at least two-thirds as a result of the conflict over the control of that particular state at that time. Now, I'm not questioning that these ideas are bad or wrong or anything, just that we have a social scientist, we have a responsibility to explain where the ideas come from. And many people don't do that. And that is part of the challenge in addressing this sort of intractable situations we are in. So ideas are embedded. And these ideas are often questioned only when internationally oriented middle class, just a civil society, that has the inclination and the power to fight and engage continuously with the elite. Unfortunately for Pakistan, the middle class is very small, And the civil society is rather weak. And the society is actually very divided among sectarian grounds, the religious grounds, especially since the post-Ziaul-Haq period. And occasionally they have shown some mettle as the lawyers fighting against the Musharraf regime. And it is slowly improving. If you read Pakistani media, especially I do some of the English newspapers, you find that there is a middle class emerging, but it is very rudimentary at this point. Or revolutionary ideas should come from abroad. Outsiders could pressure. Countries could that provide aid to Pakistan, that is mostly United States and China, or Saudi Arabia to some extent. Unfortunately, the U.S. had missed opportunities in this relationship. The U.S. aid put a lot of pressure on Korea and Taiwan to modernize, to trade, to engage in international, whereas it did not on Pakistan. That is what really is upsetting if you want to think about the normative aspect of foreign policy behavior. It's mostly a transactional relationship using Pakistan, but Pakistan elite also uses the United States. It's a two-way using which has been going on for the last 66 years. Of course, there are ups and downs periods when the relationship got really sour. And as a result, U.S. is probably the most hated country today, more than India, in Pakistan. What I do in this book, essentially, I'm trying to offer a comparative analysis. And that's probably, okay, these are some difficulties. You cannot get parity, especially since the liberalization of India in the 90s. An economy is growing, it's much bigger. And that creates a lot of disenchantment. India also helped the bifurcation of Pakistan. That is very badly felt in many Pakistani elite as well as public thinking. And it creates a lot of pathologies, dominant social role of the military, rivalry, etc. So, I go into more detail the impact of this kind of a rivalry that they are engaging in. But the comparison is very interesting because South Korea and Taiwan are two states that faced existential rivalries with their neighbors, and Taiwan especially a much bigger neighbor. And they chose a different path. Even while strengthening their military security, they adopted a different strategy. They were adopting what they call developmental state approach. The realization was that if they do not modernize, popular discontent will affect their defense. So the impact of economics on security is very powerful there. It is not to just to make everybody happy. They were modernizing, they were selling goods, but to make happy so that the country's defense would be protected. Now, this was facilitated, of course, by the Japanese colonialism. The Japanese were extremely good in developing wherever they conquered, extremely poor, extremely bad in terms of human rights and rights of people, you know, a lot of suppression and killings, as the Chinese still talk about it. But they did a lot of things, infrastructure, because they were going to migrate to those places and live there. Larger Japan, co-prosperity zone. And they destroyed the land aristocracy, created schools and quite a bit of things. So when these people were becoming independent, they had some basis to build upon. And especially, they put a lot of emphasis on technical education, science and technology. Unfortunately, Pakistan did not. In fact, even today, it has very few technical institutions, which is hurting it because India did quite a bit of technical institutions, not necessarily general education. As a result, India was a beneficiary of the post-globalization or post-liberalization phase where Indian labor, I'm sure some here too, in the IT sector and all have made use of that that connection. So Pakistan has not engaged in this sort of thing that they did. And these states also used the relationship with the United States during the Vietnam War. They were suppliers of various goods to United States and the Western countries. And they adopted what they call a policy or a mantra, export or die. Now, in Pakistan case, we have a short period under General Ayub Khan. They were doing quite well in the 50s and late 50s and up to 70 or so. But that did not last long. So Pakistan did not make use of its opportunities that the Afghan wars would have provided. but its elite was focusing on other aspects, including the development of non-state actor, of course, with the encouragement of the United States in the first round. Turkey is a fascinating case because it also had four coups. It was controlled by the military for a long period of time. Of course, a different reverse. It's trying to become a secular state. And Ataturk's modernization from top down, and that was going on. Until recently, of course, the military lost quite a bit of social power. The elite adopted modernity to some extent. And repressive policies, of course, with respect to Kurds. But the point is that it had, despite the rivalry with Greece or Cyprus, Turkey was able to balance some level of economic development. So it became a quasi-developmental state. And it also focused on trade, especially since the 90s. It became actually a fast trading state. Of course, now all the G20 are affected. And obviously Pakistan is also affected by that. Not Pakistan, so Turkey. It's also affected by the current downturn for the new emerging states. Turkey did land reforms. Pakistan did not. And that is another big change here. It adopted this partial developmental state approach and after some import substitution. But its liberalization has definitely helped it to become a lead economic state. And now Turkey is, we don't know where it is heading. The AKP has done initially some interesting things about controlling the military. But the more you hear what they are trying to do, there is great fear that Turkey may be becoming a bit like Pakistan or changing its particular goal with respect to what it is standing for. Indonesia is definitely the most interesting case here. Pakistan could take a lot of lessons from. This country also received a lot of foreign aid from the United States, and that it had a lot of internal conflicts, and the armed forces were in control. Of course, it didn't have a big rivalry with the neighbor. That's an interesting difference. But the fact of the matter is that the military wanted to retain the power in Indonesia. It was the civilians that really restrained the military, and after several attempts, managed to create a democracy. Indonesia has been ruled by elite, even the military, over kind of a semi-secular system, what you call the Pancasila system, and that they have been able to maintain a reasonable religious harmony of multi-ethnic place, despite some violence. And by 2007, the Freedom House declared Indonesia fully free. Strong-willed leaders, civilian leaders, and civil society, which actually Indonesia has a better one than Pakistan to some extent. It also adopted what you call a pro-growth policy, despite the widespread corruption. And since the Bali bombings in 2002, it started suppressing terrorist groups. And also the fact that after the tsunami, the Aceh conflict especially, was resolved up to a point because of the engagement that they had with the separatists. And they got out of East Timor. A lot of things they did show to the world that a majority Muslim state can become a democratic state, an inclusive state up to a point. Of course, it's a developing country. And also engage in international trade and other activities. Egypt is unfortunately following the Pakistani path to some extent, except that the military is now the lead actor, taking on the non-state actors. Number of similarities. One I mentioned was the geostrategic curse. It also gets about $2 billion from the U.S. The idea is that the money is given the understanding they would maintain peace with Israel. There also you have the power of the landed aristocracy, quite similar to Pakistan. And so that country is going through the Arab Spring, you know the story. It is going through big changes, overthrew Mubarak, and then Morsi came and he adopted a Islamist agenda. The military is now back and maybe for foreseeable future. Let me conclude by a few points. I know I have only four more minutes left, and I want to say that my general arguments about war and state making in today's world. The time argument, people argue that Pakistan had been in existence for only 66 years. Perhaps European states took 400 years or 500 years. I argue that you look at the cases that you address that became strong, it took a shorter period. Taiwan and Korea, I mentioned. China, since Deng Xiaoping's period, is less than two decades. And all the other states in Asia Pacific that became strong happened only a very short period of time. Reverse, you have some 150 years of history for Latin American states, and most of them haven't gotten strong. So time is compressed today, and without Deng Xiaoping's reforms, China would be a basket case. Therefore, you need to reform. Countries need to reform. This large-scale war-making is no longer a mechanism for transformation. Pakistan has to encourage its younger generation to globalize, not the worst part of globalization, but the better part of globalization. It has to allow its younger generation, not just the top tier that managed to come to Western universities, but from all segments of its society. It has to encourage science and technology. That it doesn't, and that is part of the challenge. Pakistan has missed out the post-war, post-Cold War economic boom and the globalization associated benefits such as international trade, investment, mobility of workforce, etc. None of the crises it faces has been enough to change the elite side ideas, so major transformation is necessary the way they look at peace, the way they look at relationships. Obviously, they cannot wait for settling all the territorial disputes they have with the neighbors, even though they may have a point of view. But the point is that you trade with these neighbors, and over time, hopefully, there will be better relations to get territorial concessions, as China and India are doing today. So I argue that China has a big role to play here. It doesn't, unfortunately. It is using it as a balance of power, realpolitik thing with India, although it is starting to build some infrastructure, etc. U.S. especially has to really refocus on development of Pakistan and Afghanistan as opposed to this military relationship it has built. Aid should be very much tied to development as opposed to military systems. And the U.S. can help to develop a regional economic arrangement, a connectivity, but I don't know how deeply they are willing to do that. India can help by not securitizing its relationship more, as water disputes, for instance, or repressive policies in Kashmir, open up the Indian economy a little bit more to the Pakistanis, although they have, but Pakistan is not reciprocating. That's the argument you get. But clearly, regional institution building is crucial here. They need to improve that part. To conclude, Pakistani media and leading commentators are writing more on the need for economic approach and changing the dynamics. Official discourse reflects some rethinking, but it is very difficult to predict the trajectory of Pakistan. One thing is clear, a country that has 110 to 150 nuclear weapons and is building rapidly what you call a tactical weapons or short-range weapons to put on the border, that its future affects the future of the region, the world, and the 2 billion South Asians, almost 2 billion South Asians, whether they live in poverty or in security, will be dependent partly on what Pakistan does or Pakistan's future. So I'm right on time, 35 minutes. Thank you. So I guess Benjamin will give us his take on my video.
Thank you. My name is Benjamin Cohen. I'm an associate professor in the Department of History, where I teach courses on India and South Asia. Let me very quickly welcome UTV to the University of Utah. Let me also thank my friends and colleagues in the Department of Political Science, the Hinckley Center, and the Asia Center, all for helping sponsor this event. Let me also say, as you suggested, that I'm really the wrong Cohen to comment on your work, but I'll try. Your book, Warrior State, is elegant, timely, and convincingly argued, but it's not particularly uplifting, and I have a few questions along that front. First, by choosing the analytic category of warrior state, I wonder if it might be the case of when you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In other words, what might happen if we called Pakistan a hampered state, an impinged state, a struggling state, or some other name? Might a different vision of Pakistan's past, present, or future emerge, or is the data so convincing that warrior state, as you've called it, is the best fit? And perhaps you could comment on the choice of warrior state as your organizing paradigm. Second, on Islam. On the one hand, Islam was the core idea behind the creation of Pakistan. Yet on the other, as you've demonstrated in the book, it hasn't worked particularly well to unify Pakistan. And on a third hand, I have three hands, it's also part of the elite's mindset. And in short, I wonder if you could perhaps reflect on where you see the role of Islam being in Pakistan today and where it's taking the country. Third, and here you have to pardon my training as a historian, I'm curious to what extent the role that Pakistan plays as a Mughal successor state is part of the everyday discourse. Of course, that was what the British thought of themselves, especially after the middle of the 19th century, as inheriting the Mughals' mantle for control of South Asia. And to what extent is that idea still prevalent in Pakistan today? And finally, in different places throughout the book, you suggest the roads not taken by Pakistan. And you've also alluded to this in your wonderful talk today. For instance, land reform, economic development, democratic inclusiveness. Yet I wonder, first, what are Pakistan's roads ahead from which the country might yet be able to choose? And second, to what extent is India ready to elect, I think, a Hindu nationalist coalition later this spring with Narendra Modi at its helm, a man who oversaw the butchery of 2002? To what extent is India not drifting towards becoming its own religious nationalist state? And what future under a Modi government in India and a Sharif government in Pakistan might these two South Asian superpowers have? So with that, I can turn it over to a response.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
All the big questions.
I do have a response.
Then I guess we can take more. To begin with the first question, why did I choose? My title was a rather boring academic title, what I just gave you today. War and State Building, Pakistan and Comparative Perspective. My editor thought that will sell about 20 copies. But I agreed with him because people try to describe Pakistan as a garrison state, a Praetorian state, and a warrior state actually captures a lot of Pakistan. It's a deeply militarized state, social values, the way the school textbooks talk about war and peace. And the fact that its main purpose is defense, or defense from one's perspective. And all the other goals are subsidiary. So it's a bit like Wilhelmine Germany in a very poor country. So that is, and the land aristocracy and the military have big relationship. This is where I think this term captures a lot of ground. Of course, it upsets some people. I think it's hard to take that kind of. But it isn't. Warriors is also a good term, okay? It's an honorable thing to be waging wars. If you ask the German officer corps, you are a historian, it's fascinating stuff they write about what we are supposed to do as men of honor. All right. The role of Islam, I discuss quite a bit in the book. I have nothing against Islam, by the way. I'm very respectful of Islam in my daily life, as well as I have a lot of good friends. And the only thing I discuss is the political Islam, the use of political Islam by different groups. Pakistan was not founded as a typical Islamic state as we think. Muhammad Ali Jinnah had a secular strand to him too. He was one of the biggest defenders of the Hindu-Muslim unity. Only he turned around because of certain internal politics and the way the Congress Party treated him to some extent. But what I look at from period to period is the progressive use of political Islam by certain forces that even the secular individuals have to now agree. And that, I think, starts quite a bit with Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's period rather than Ziaul Haq, as we generally think. Because Bhutto was the one who banned the Ahmadi group, for instance. So a lot of choices they made created sectarianism. The Ahmadis are not Islamic, according to the Pakistani or rulers. And the involvement in all Afghanistan, later on leading to this Sunni-Shia divide. Shias are a minority, as you know. And as a result, today, even the most peaceful group, that is Ismailis, are facing violence from the particular groups. So what is the future here? Nobody, as far as I know, is ready to take on political Islam in Pakistan. Although one has to look at how many people support them, the political parties of extreme right wing. The support varies from 10 to 11 to 12%. It's not very high, actually. That's something very positive you have to think about. But there is an Islamist strand in most of the political parties. They do. And my fear right now is, what are they really negotiating with the Taliban? They're not revealing. I'm talking about the internal Pakistani Taliban. Any concession they make will be going to hurt Pakistan in the tolerance area. Taliban is not going to be happy with what it is, what it sees. So in a sense, the future is very unpredictable. And what will happen to Afghanistan? What will happen to the Taliban there? Will they have a link with the Pakistani Taliban? And what will that affect in terms of internal politics? You mentioned this not a daily discourse. No, actually, I look at it as the elite's idea of statehood. Ordinary fellows, although there are some quotations I have in the book, suggest that we're told that this is what we are. You know, Jinnah was the viceroy, a regal, top Shahenshah. You know, that was the idea. But it really changed, and now there is a realization that it's never going to become successor state. Obviously, that is not. But it does resonate in the elite's thinking. Ordinary fellows may not think about that way. But it is initial discussion. I have lots of quotes on why they looked at it that way. And even if you want to say it's no longer there, but I think it is there. That is, otherwise we cannot explain this competition with India. Now you say Kashmir, of course the initial problem was that, but that has gone into multiple directions now. Majority of Kashmiris, by the way, want independence from India and Pakistan. And neither wants to give that. So what are we talking about if Pakistan gets Kashmir, and what will happen? It will become Balochistan or an Afghanistan, no? Because the people there don't want any outsiders to control them. So this is not a good reason to compete India so intensely for creating this parity. It's something to do deeper than that, than territorial. I'm not saying it is not part of the discourse or the issue. Finally, the road's not taken. You definitely touched on my real beef here, which is this elite had an opportunity. They were close to the United States, as the Koreans and the Taiwanese were. They missed it, except for Ayub Khan. By the way, he was a smart bugger. He did quite a bit of things, but he let Zulfikar Ali Bhutto and group to start the 65 war, which disastrous for them. And then later on, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto again comes across as the guy who prevented the Bengalis from forming the government, and then obviously these are simplified arguments. Obviously, they interacted, and Bengalis were also not easy to deal with, and it led to India's intervention, etc. Is India going in that direction? There is obviously some fear whether Modi is a changed man or not. There's a powerful group in India, I mean, intellectuals think that he is a changed man. His goal is to make India a great power. Therefore, he may do the Vajpayee thing, like going to Lahore, etc. My fear is the following, that Modi may try all that, but the BJP may stroke up some crises to shore up their domestic support, especially if they are a weak government. And the other fear I have is about textbooks. The BJP, during the first previous government, they changed Indian textbooks quite a bit, as the Pakistani textbooks are not the best in terms of learning the history of South Asia, as you know. And if India and the Congress Party, the government, they change some of that, India follows through that, it will be really disastrous for generations to come. But I'm not that worried about, as people say, he's probably quite a bit changed man. He's getting support even among some Muslims, by the way, not justifying his cruelty in the 2002 conflict. But clearly this is a big change for the region, and if he manages to pull it off, he has some instincts, industrialization, and economic, he has a relationship with Japan, etc. But he definitely has to work very hard. And there are at least two schools. One school, what you said, another school, that he may pull it off because he's a right winger. He can do certain things that the Congress people can't. It's like the Israeli, right wingers as left wingers. But anyway, your questions are quite deep, and like I said, this is an extremely complex country, and every day things are changing. What we can do is to pull out some of these dominant themes and strands, to create a coherent analysis, which is can change if somebody has a different, broader perspective. Thank you.
We understand here. We have 5 minutes left.
If you have a question, please just raise your hand and then stand and state your name. You might have to meet me halfway.
Didn't work. You have to come closer.
John Francis, political science. My question is, I noticed, I'm happy that you're in each other's state.
But I wasn't so sure why you didn't include Japan or recognize in Imperial Germany that both of those countries also had military that were not particularly under control, but also achieved enormous economic growth that only fed into the military. So I was wondering if you had seen, if Pakistan were to experience economic growth, would it, in your judgment, weaken the role of the military or only increase its capacity?
That's a very profound question. I must argue that, I must say that there are two sides to this war on state building. The European experience, at least these two states, and the Japanese have obviously followed the European. But what is noticeable in the Japan case is the Meiji Restoration by a civil society that brought in an empire, you know, emperor, and transformed top down. Now, both these places are ethnically almost homogeneous places. They have a lot of conditions. The elite definitely want to go ahead, allowing this intense push for domination. But when they arrived at the world stage, the world was already divided by the colonial powers, the Anglo-Saxon powers very much, and France. And therefore, they had nothing to conquer. And that is one explanation for why they felt that they were sidelined by the dominant powers of the system. So they had the domestic conditions, if I'm not a great historian of these two countries, for the push of a military sort of approach. But the point is that they had done a lot of reforms beforehand, except the landed aristocracy in Germany, probably. But they were in the European context, at least in Japan, in engaging the European countries. And that they had an elite that also had a different agenda, development-wise as well. But I wouldn't say that militarism did wonders for them. They're catastrophic wars, and they became extremely weak as a result. Even today, they are quasi-independent states. Unfortunately, they have not become. So militarism has its, if you want to look at the deep-rooted problem of militarism, is only when they abandoned militarism, they became acceptable to their neighbors, Japan still not completely, because it hasn't abandoned some of the things it did under military regimes, and that civilian powers, civilianization, and natural decent policies were necessary for them to be accepted by their neighbors. So Pakistan has not really come a comparative case because it didn't go through those motions that these states did.
Brent Steele, political science. Thanks a lot for your talk. It was very interesting and very provocative. So I actually had a question of regarding the geostrategic curse that you mentioned regarding Pakistan. And I like the way that you set this all up as a social scientific question, but it feels to me like there's a very, I mean, based on good, effective reasoning, there's a real normative argument here towards the end that you're making regarding the liberalization or the economic development of Pakistan. But I wonder how that sounds to me then that Pakistan has a lot of agency, or you assume that it has a lot of agency to be able to do that, maybe during some of these periods that you talk about, these missed opportunities. But how does it escape the geostrategic curse when it comes to its role as a war-making state and its position internationally? Especially if you consider the you mentioned this just briefly, that the United States is more hated now than India. Well, one of the obvious reasons is it has these flying robots that can kill people, right, above parts of Pakistan. And so I'm wondering, how does Pakistan escape a situation like that where the United States...
How can it escape, or how did it escape in the past?
Or a better way for me to put it, I guess, would be how can it cope with its geostrategic position while still doing what you'd like to see it do, which you make a very persuasive case for why it should do that.
Well, I think if you look at my explanation, look, I don't treat the geostrategic part or the structural part as the only part of my explanation. That's why I brought in the ideas and strategies of the elite. I think this is my contribution, if you want to argue that way, because most analysts would look at what the others did, the great powers. So that's where I also have comparison with other countries like Korea and Taiwan. What this agency, that their ideas, is not. I don't want to blame them. Their ideas are derived from a set of notions that may be civilizationally driven, religiously driven, ideologically driven, etc. One thing is very clear, that they had a very good savvy negotiators. There's a fascinating book by Teresita Schaefer and Howard Schaefer called How Pakistan Negotiates, and in which they argue that it really has good negotiators. Recently, somebody has quoted me this statement by President Sardari to visiting American Secretary, said, "We are your Lehman Brothers. You collapse, you know what happens." And so in this book, they have this interesting accounts of how Pakistani negotiators, the top-ranking negotiators, would negotiate with the United States, arguing that you really need to help us in aid, not trade. This is where my problem with this elite is. And they are very sharp in that. It's asymmetric negotiation. There is actually some books on the subject of how the weaker parties negotiate. In fact, Canada-U.S. trade negotiations, usually Canada wins. You know why? Canadian diplomats come more prepared. They have a better case to make. And then they will usually prevail. Not everywhere, but this is what negotiation has been taking place. Interesting example, the Shimla meeting between Mrs. Gandhi and Mr. Bhutto after the 1971 war. Bhutto comes pleading to Gandhi, saying that, look, if you don't let my soldiers go, you don't give me territory back, you conquered, when I go back, I will be assassinated. You will have a military in charge to negotiate. Do you want that to happen? And Mrs. Gandhi falls for it. And that's, some people say, why that agreement... A winner did not get all that it could have achieved. But then he goes back and initiates the nuclear weapons program, saying, we will eat grass for 1,000 years. Even if we have to eat grass for 1,000 years, we will equalize this power relationship that was just lost in the parity. So that's what I mean by the elite is very savvy. They're educated and very well educated. That's the case with most of the military states in the world. You know, they are really driven by a particular... I do have a normative argument. I think a social scientist should come up with conclusions. I don't do a lot of that in the book because my editor thought that'll make it like too much of a, you know, nice-hearted fellow trying to tell the Pakistanis do this way, that way, you know. So I had to cut down that of that. But what comes out of that is that our research findings should have some relevance. And what I am recommending to the Pakistani elite, not to read this book with kind of a defensive position, but to look at it kind of comparative and say that what else we could have done. Now, times have flown. I mean, what can we do next? I would encourage them, first of all, start at least 200 engineering colleges. Okay, you're not going to get teachers easily, but try to attract your expatriate students or teachers. Create 10 or 15 special economic zones. And ask the Chinese to come and invest. Of course, security is the biggest concern. Create all you can. Protect those places. Road transport, network. Use your relationship with China, with the U.S., with all the Gulf countries. Saudi Arabia just gave $1.5 billion as an aid. Not going to help. Saudi Arabia has to keep trade. And develop your niche, which is cotton, used to be cotton. Now it is Bangladesh, number one. Cotton seller. And they have a lot of little industries they can develop. Obviously, it's going to be a long way to go. It has also some benefits in terms of expatriates. You know, there's connection that they can build on. But the point is that their argument is, until we settle all the security problems internally and externally, we don't want to talk about trade, which is changing slowly. But same with the United States. They should open up with India trade India is ready. Now, that is being prevented by some say the military, some say the small-scale industries, and then allow the Central Asians to trade through India, create a gas pipeline, you know, the whole energy could be a major source of connectivity, especially hydropower, etc. All these require a certain amount of giving up some of these traditional ideas that we are talked about. And I think it's important to think of the big picture. The great rapprochement, sort of pushing as a someone who likes to see South Asia emerging. Otherwise, what is the alternative for that region?
Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking Dr. Paul.
Oh. Thank you very much. Appreciate your...